Me, Jackie, and Matt Gourley are fixing to R-U-N-N-O-F-T. But first, we're going to talk about the Coen Southern Odyssey, Oh Brother, Where Art Thou, starring George Clooney. I mean, we're already here. We might as well. JFIO presents.
What? Are you kidding? We got us a family here.
This ain't no coon, huh?
Okay, I'm not going to sit here and debate.
I'll show you the life of a blind!
You will find a fortune. It would not be the fortune you seek.
I suppose you think you're raised hell.
When I'm raised hell, you know it.
Something is very wrong. I don't want Santana Abraxas. I've just been in a terrible auto accident.
What's the most you ever lost in the coin toss?
Sometimes knowledge is yours.
Accept the mystery, a Coen Brothers podcast.
Welcome back to another episode of Accept the Mystery, a Coen Brothers podcast, where we cover every single Coen Brothers movie in chronological order in absurd, extreme, encyclopedic, excruciating levels of line-by-line detail. My name is Josh Richmond. We are recording today's podcast in a room full of, like, a lot of cool exotic instruments. I think there's a slide guitar, and I don't know what... Maybe that's a lute?
That's
a mandolin.
A lute.
I don't know. I think a lute is just an old-timey version of the same. Isn't it? It's just another
actually,
string.
It's probably different.
I could get into it. It's not, but you don't want to hear that.
I kind of do, actually.
A lute has something like a ton of strings, like 10 strings, and it has a bent neck. A mandolin can have a gored back and look like a lute.
Okay.
So there's like a modern mandolin, which is like you would see here, or in the music they'd play in Oh Brother, Where Art Thou.
Right.
It's in that movie. And then they just have eight strings, two of the same note. So it's four couplets of strings.
Got it. Yeah, no, I know they've got the coupled strings. But yeah, I didn't realize a lute had like 10 strings on it.
The tuning keys bend at a right angle in the back. It's strange.
Hmm. That's awesome.
Not that I even know anything more than a lute than that. I've never touched one. But
I mean, it's completely appropriate that we're surrounded by these instruments for this particular movie. This is an awesome setting. With me is my co-host, Jackie Lechtoldsee.
Hey.
Jackie, are you amazed we actually made it here and watched this movie in time for this podcast?
It was like an endless odyssey, and now it is finally happening.
It is finally happening. I guess, should we just explain that off the top, what happened?
Okay, we'll just do it real quick.
Yeah, no, right. I want to hear this.
Yeah, it was absurd.
Okay, so...
Really? Wow.
So Thursday night was the only night that we could actually watch this.
Because I should just say, I sat down on my couch and watched
right.
It was the simplest process.
You would think,
right.
Yeah.
It seemed so simple. We just planned it out. Okay, I'm going to go over to Jackie's house and we'll download the movie and then we'll watch the movie.
The problem was I was at work late. I had like a really late night every night. And so right. I was like, oh, I was rushing back. So that's why I usually watch it at Josh's. And then this time we're like, oh, we should watch it at mine because I'll find it.
Right. Easier for her. Usually it hasn't been a problem for us to just quickly download it and watch it. This time we shouldn't have put off the downloading because as soon as we got to Jackie's house, we ran into internet streaming issues.
Oh, no.
Always
the worst.
Worst
internet ever. Mm-hmm. And it was a moment where it just was definitely not going to help. It wasn't going to work. Yeah.
No. So we uninstalled and reinstalled the routers to see if we could get the download speeds up, and eventually we realized, okay, we're just not, iTunes is just not going to help us out here. We need to rush over to the nearest Starbucks before it closes and find any sort of Wi-Fi connection and just start downloading something.
Yeah. And I'll note that you already bought it on iTunes, and I already bought it on Amazon streaming, trying to set it up before Josh got there, which is when I realized things were going awry. And then he arrives like 5 minutes later. I was like, oh, this isn't working.
And I'd rented the movie a couple days earlier, so we'd thrown like $12 towards the movie Oh Brother, Where Art Thou, which is why I didn't feel bad about eventually torrenting it on Pirate Bay when we did get to Starbucks.
You paid your dues.
It was sure. 100%.
But then we're in the Starbucks, and we're like trying to download on iTunes, and we realize it's too slow. And then I was like, all right, it's not going to work. So we torrented it.
God.
And then it's like 10:30. We're standing around the table and the guy's like, okay, we're closing. I was like, can you just not turn your internet off? And they're like, we don't turn it off. And we were like, oh my God. So then we sit outside of the Starbucks waiting for it to download.
Yeah.
I think it finished around maybe 10:45, 10:48. We finished downloading and then we went back to my house.
But it's, you know, literally staring at the screen, like willing it to watching the download speed go up and go down. And like,
Oh my God.
Yeah. And it was also...
I'm nervous just listening.
Yeah.
It was very nerve-wracking.
It was nerve-wracking.
Yeah. And then by then we're like, it was so late because we were planning to start watching, I think around 9. So we're like, oh, 9 to 11, we'll be done.
Yeah.
And then of course we started watching at 11. So we finished at 1. And I'm already like, oh my God, I have to wake up early for work. And it's like this whole thing, but we're like, no, we have to watch
it.
And
it made it meaningful when we did finally get the movie downloaded. And we felt like we'd gone through this journey and accomplished something in time to watch it, which thematically worked out.
Mm-hmm.
And that's all that matters.
Wow. When was this? What night was this?
This was Thursday night.
Thursday. That's what when I watched mine.
Yeah.
You're just sitting at home watching it.
We could have watched it together, and I'm just,
we could have. We probably could have.
I was seriously just lying on the couch. In fact, I have this on standard def DVD, but I really love this movie, so, and I know Roger Deakins is a cinematographer, yeah. So I downloaded it in high def because I wanted to see what it looked like. And
it's worth watching the high def version. This is a movie where every shot looks like a painting. Honestly. We also wrote your first screenplay ever.
That's true.
That's the other positive thing that came out of that experience.
What do you mean?
While we were waiting for the movie to download, I taught Jackie how to use Final Draft.
Oh, so nice.
She successfully wrote her first screenplay ever.
That's good use of time.
We were multitasking.
Yeah, you made lemons out of lemonade.
We sure did.
That is the expression.
Yeah.
Yeah, if we didn't have that, you know, that late situation, I would have never known that I could be such a prolific writer.
No.
Are you about to read it?
Yeah, I think
it's very short.
This is your actual screenplay?
This is the screenplay that she wrote, her first ever screenplay.
I love it.
It's a masterpiece.
All right, you can read it.
Well,
that's fine.
Well, wait. Actually, because there's two characters in it named Josh and Jackie. Somebody's got to read stage directions. Would you mind reading stage directions?
Not at all. I'd be happy to. All right. Exterior, Brentwood Street corner outside of Starbucks, 10:38 p.m. Jackie is giving Josh a lot of attitude. Attitude he doesn't deserve, especially because finally, things are looking up. They found internet. Josh is teaching Jackie how to write a screenplay.
See, just hit enter and it lets you start writing dialogue.
Wait, I think I just did it.
Josh is stunned.
That's amazing. Good for you.
Jackie is beaming. She's speechless. The end.
The end.
A Coen Brothers joke.
That's fantastic.
Yeah. I think that's Coen Brothers.
You got all the main things in there. You got your exterior, you know, your log line and all that stuff.
Every element is, it's in there. Yeah, we're talking to the Coens right now. We're trying to sign into a deal to direct
it. It's quirky enough for them, I'll tell you that.
I think so. I'd like to think so. Anyhow, the other voice that I've put off enough time actually producing
never
for this podcast, he is an improviser, he's a podcaster. You've
heard him on programs like Comedy Bang Bang, the Andy Daly Podcast Pilot Project,
and the inimitable Super Ego, which just began its fourth season. And if you haven't listened to the season premiere yet, you should stop this podcast and smash your phone into a million pieces and go buy a new phone and then download it.
The iPhone 6.
Or whatever, anything that plays podcasts. Please welcome Matt Gorley to the show.
Thank you for having me. I'm excited to talk about it.
Thank you for coming, and thank you for letting us into your room full of exotic instruments and recording this podcast.
Thank you.
This is sweet.
Thanks. These are my babies.
Did you literally, like, birth these?
It feels like it, because I learned on so many of them. But that one right behind you, that electric guitar on the right.
Uh-huh. Oh, with, like, the wooden one?
Yeah. Do you want to know who used to own that?
Yes.
Who used to own that?
David Koresh, the Waco, Texas cult leader.
Oh, my God.
Isn't that creepy?
Whoa.
Yeah.
Played some beautiful songs about how he's a human god or something.
Yeah. Oh, my God.
I was told that after I bought it, though, just so you know.
That's so crazy.
But they told it to me, like, he would never buy, you know, no one would ever buy this if they knew. And I was like, I don't know, I might kind of pay extra, maybe.
Might kind of tell people about it when they come over.
It's an infamous instrument.
Wow.
Yeah.
That's so crazy.
They might have been strumming that as gunfire was being fired at them.
It's very likely. I do know that that was not at the compound in Texas. He left it behind in San Francisco as he went to Texas. So it didn't get to see the great cult days.
Oh, well. Still a piece of history.
Yeah, indirectly it has blood on
it. You don't have to tell people that. You can say it was there when all the murdering was happening.
Oh, God. Crazy.
Okay, so we should get into our very first segment, which is where we ask our guests questions loosely inspired by the movie of the week in a segment called Inside Matt Gorley.
Okay.
So, Matt.
Can I first just say your little interstitial musics in your intro was fantastic.
Thank you.
Wow.
You know, all Coen Brothers music.
Yeah.
So, early in the film, a blind seer tells our heroes their fortune. Matt, have you ever had your fortune told? And did the prediction come true?
Boy, I don't know that I ever have. I know when I was very young, my dad took me and my sister a couple years in a row to the Renaissance Pleasure Fair. I grew up in Southern California.
Uh-huh. I know the Renaissance Pleasure Fair.
Like both
we all do.
Comic-Con and the Renaissance Fair all started humbly, and for like 10 years they kind of remained at one level, then they blew up.
Right.
So this was before it blew up.
Right, yeah. As the nerd culture started blowing up, those became gigantic events.
Yeah, mm-hmm. And I remember there were fortune tellers there, And I think we got some sort of fortune, but I don't remember what it was. All that sticks with me was there was like a tightrope you could walk that was like a foot off the ground. And if you could make it across like 5 feet, you got to like French kiss this wench. This was so, this like was before things were really standardized. And things were a little creepy right. and weird there at that time. And
I remember, much like the actual Renaissance.
Yeah. And I remember seeing that and going like, this is the first time as a boy I had seen anything like that live. And I was like, well, yeah, something's very clear to me now with what needs to happen or something. I don't know. So maybe in a way that was my fortune. That's when I knew I was ready for a woman.
I don't know. I mean, that's like, great. I have had tarot card readings before.
Oh, yeah?
Yeah.
Yeah.
But they're always so vague that I don't even, if it did come true, I wouldn't remember.
Yeah.
It's just like, you know, you will find your path and a great man will appear to help you accomplish your goal.
Of
like,
course.
Okay, sure. That could mean
I know a great man. I know a great man right now. Yeah. It must be him.
They always appeal to your vanities or your predilections and stuff too. Like, you're a very warm person. Who doesn't want to believe that about themselves?
Nope, they'll never say you're a very cold person.
If a fortune teller could come along and nail all my weaknesses and flaws, then I would start believing.
That is true. Yeah. I don't think I've had my fortune read.
Really?
Disappointing. Yeah.
You should. Just so you can...
just so I could say that I have.
Yeah.
So you can say that
for
you have.
Podcast. I don't think I have.
I don't know. And I know that I'm really susceptible to, like, horoscopes. I will sometimes flip across, like, I don't believe in astrology at all. Yeah. But if I see something like Aquarius at the coffee bean, it says, you know, Aquarius, today you will find a new angle on the obstacles in your path. And then it'll be like, okay, maybe I will. And then I'll start looking for it.
Yeah.
I mean, even if it's a placebo effect,
right?
It kind of works.
They're fun to read.
Well, I don't know about the daily horoscopes, how accurate they are, but I think the ones that are, well, I think like the horoscopes of people's actual signs are very accurate to how people are. I'll say
do you really think that?
I do.
So how am I like...
What's your sign?
I'm a Virgo.
Well, it's such like a Virgo.
Such a Virgo thing to say.
Yeah, it's a very Virgo thing.
No, but I mean, maybe not every single detail, but like if... Because, you know, Franco is also into astrology. One of our teammates, and she's also... I will note... She's a medical student.
She is a medical student, which makes it all the more bizarre.
How does she reconcile that?
Like that?
Yeah.
Right?
Well, and I'm with her, but I guess her dad had done like a lot of astrological work, and there was a lot of things that he like predicted or mapped out or was able to, you know, decipher through what he had studied. I think there's like the common level of it, and then there's like people who actually are really into it, and I think the people who are like really into it have a...
Is it her dad a philosopher?
I don't know. I don't remember.
I feel like you could just logically be like, there's no way the cycles of stars have anything to do with our life on Earth.
Well, I don't know, because like the moon affects the tides and stuff, and like the planets, you know.
I don't mean to play devil's advocate here.
Please do.
But I think it was Neil deGrasse Tyson who really put it, that was when it really sunk in with me, that the obstetrician delivering you as a baby has like 100 times more gravity pull than the moon or any astrological being when you're born, so that it can't possibly affect...
That's true, right?
Yeah. So you're more influenced by your doctor physically as mass than you ever are as like astrological body.
You know what I did hear once? I did hear a theory that it doesn't necessarily have anything to do with like what constellation is above you as you're born, but perhaps being born like during the winter as opposed to during the summer, that the light cycles have some effect on your personality, maybe.
We're really covering it today, guys.
I think so.
We cover the bases. We get into this is a comprehensive podcast, if you didn't hear
Coen Brothers haven't done anything like astrologically related, have they? Is there any of that theme in there?
I think fortune telling and fate is a major theme of this film.
That's true.
We'll dive into that as we start getting into the reviews. Yeah. First, I have more questions for you.
Oh, sorry.
Excuse us.
I'm a Gemini. Just if that was...
Oh, such a Gemini.
Okay. Well, that answers my next five
or six
questions.
Skeptical Gemini.
So, oh brother, where art thou, paints a not always flattering portrait of the Depression-era South, which I've never actually been to the South. I've been to Texas, but I don't feel like that's the same thing as the South. It's kind of its own beast. Have you spent much time in the South, and how much does it resemble the hillbilly stereotype, in your opinion?
This summer was the first time I spent any real time in the South. I was in Sullivan's Island in South Carolina for a week.
That's cool.
So, but it was like a nice little island beach town. I don't think I got the full Southern experience.
It's more like where like Southerners go to like vacation, yeah, or summer homes and things like that.
Yeah. And I mean, the one thing that was kind of interesting was the Civil War history, and you could see a couple of the forts off the islands and stuff like that. And then I spent a few days in New Orleans, but again, that was it's kind of its own thing. So I don't have a feel for that, though. I feel very drawn to it for some reason. When I saw this movie in, what was this, 2000 or 2001?
I want to say 2001.
This was like the height of my love of playing like banjo and mandolin and things like that. So this movie was everything to me when it came out because of the music. Yeah. I feel tied to the South in that way. For some reason, like my Irish ancestry comes and, you know, populates the Appalachians and plays all that bluegrass music and stuff that I love.
Oh.
You know, I don't know that I have any real connection to it, but I just love it.
Yeah.
Did you see like any like Confederate flags anywhere? If you're talking about seeing forts and stuff like that, are there still Confederate flags hanging around in the South?
I don't think I did because where I was kind of touristy, and I think they're a little aware that I might be
like hide the flag.
Yeah, yeah,
right.
I don't think we did.
At some point, they say, "Hey, the Yankee's gone. Go put up the flag again."
Yeah, yeah. Right when you know, right the day after Labor Day, all the Confederate flags. Yeah. Back up.
All right, summer's over. We can go back to
more the white. Real, the real and South. Everybody put up your stars and bars.
That's so funny.
There's a couple political rallies in this picture, from fairly innocuous concerts to fairly terrifying Klan lynchings. Have you ever been a political activist or participated in a political rally? And what did you think of the experience if you did?
Boy, I wouldn't consider myself overly political in terms of opinions. I mean, I certainly have my opinions, but I'm incredibly interested in politics. I love reading about politics. For some reason, I'm fascinated with the Nixon Watergate era. I was born right in the middle of that.
Yeah.
My parents were kind of Nixon. Well, they weren't told. They were conservative, but Nixon was still a joke in our household. And I'm not conservative, but I love that era for some reason.
I like to think it's, you know, I think probably being in California, you're like, you got to know Nixon a little bit before the rest of the country.
Yeah, and I grew up in Whittier where Nixon was raised. He was born in Yorba Linda, but raised in Whittier. And the theater where he met his wife was the theater that I did my first play in and stuff like that. So the ghosts of Nixon are everywhere.
Yeah.
Even in this room.
I mean, no.
Nixon's guitar.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah.
I have these little Nixon buttons.
And one that says Ike on it.
Yeah, Ike and Dick. He was vice president.
That's right.
Yeah.
Eisenhower was kind of an underrated president.
I love Eisenhower. Yeah. I mean, he, you know, had some problems, but I really love that guy.
I mean, partly I feel like he just kind of got lucky just happening to preside over the country at a time where things were just peaceful and there was an economic boom, but he seemed like a chill guy.
Yeah.
And he was like right about that military-industrial
complex. I know, huh?
Yeah.
Yeah, that's 100%. His most everlasting quote. But that amazing what he pulled with the D-Day invasion and everything. He was ahead of everything at that point, and that's crazy.
No, 100%. I went to college at UC Santa Cruz, which is full of a lot of, not just liberalists, but people kind of discovering liberalism for the first time.
Were you guys the banana slugs?
We sure were. Oh, yeah. We sure were the banana slugs.
Right there. The most liberal of mascots.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, we don't want to play. We're not violent in any way, not even remotely. We're a sports team who's not going to hurt you.
We exist only to be crushed.
Yep. Or kissed, if you believe in the Santa Cruz legends.
Oh.
Supposedly, you kiss a banana slug and it brings you good luck.
Wow.
Yeah. If you actually do it, it just numbs your lips.
Really?
Because banana slugs have kind of like a numbing agent on them if you touch them.
Really? Wow.
Yeah.
Weird.
Wow. Weird. They're also the animal with the longest penis length to body length ratio. Their penis is 5 times the length of their body.
What?
Yeah. Little known
fact. So does it just tuck in to its... Wait, what?
Because it's... Because it's like a long rope. Wow. So if it decides to fully unfurl, it's mostly penis.
Yeah. Oh my God.
That's so weird.
Wow. Hats off, banana slug.
Yeah.
Right? Yeah. Good for you guys. But I remember there was... the cafeteria workers went on strike one year. And they were, they were kind of picketing a little bit, but it went to a whole new level when the students realized it and decided, we're going to help all the strikers. So they full-on, like, half the campus went on, decided to go on strike with them, which meant basically not going to classes setting up tents at the base of the campus where they, like, stayed full-time to support the workers, which was basically just an excuse to go to summer camp.
That's amazing.
I went down there and hung out a little bit, and it was fun, but... It definitely made me a bit cynical. Like, you're just doing this for the experience. You're not doing it because you care.
Yeah. That's too bad. How about you, Jackie?
Yeah. I've been thinking this whole time, and I don't think I've... don't really think I've had a specifical event like that.
I love that word.
It's kind of nice, right? Yeah. Specifical.
Let's more, put that in the lexicon. That's
more,
really good.
It's more specific than specific. It's specifical.
Yeah, I haven't had such a specifical experience.
That has so much of a better sound than specific. Specific is harsh. Specifical. It's friendly.
Yeah, it's so inviting.
It's inclusive yet exclusive.
Mm-hmm. I don't think I have participated in anything like that.
Well, shame
it's
on you.
It's as boring as it gets.
Shame on you for not being a proper American citizen.
You're not a proper American citizen, and you just have all these kids on your campus trying to go live in tents. That doesn't mean you're part of an experience.
Yeah, but I was there.
Oh, you were there.
I was there, and I held a sign, and I chanted. I don't remember what I chanted, but I remember chanting.
I'm sure there's something that's just not coming to me, and it's just not going to.
All right.
Nothing specifical.
I volunteered to do phone banks for a presidential campaign one time.
Which presidential campaign?
Obama.
Obama. Okay, yeah. That's a good one. Yeah.
That's a good example.
Like, by default, I did carry, though, thinking back, like, that was more just to fight the alternative, I guess. I don't know.
I don't know anybody who loved Kerry. It was just an I hate Bush campaign all around.
Yeah, I think so.
All right. So now that we've gotten to know our guests a little bit, it's time to dive into the movie of the week in a segment called The Big Reviewski. So, Oh Brother, Where Art Thou? Yeah, released in, like, I want to say 2001. On a personal level, this is the first Coen Brothers movie I ever saw.
Oh.
Yeah. I remember really clearly, actually. It was one winter that my dad decided to take me to, like, a movie double feature. Which, you know, the illegal double feature where you buy a ticket for one movie, watch it, then stay in the theater and decide to stick around for another movie.
The illegal double feature.
Yeah. Crouching Tiger, Hidden Dragon, and Oh Brother, Where Art Thou?
Oh, my God.
Oh, funny.
And Crouching Tiger, I remember liking it a lot at the time, but I've never seen it since. It was just kind of a solid action movie. But, but Oh Brother really stuck with me. I think it is one of those movies that really changed the way I look at movies, just because I mean, even beyond the plot and the dialogue, which is so distinctive, and the story structure and everything, on just a visual and an audio level, is such a gorgeous movie. And I think I'd never seen a movie like that before.
Yeah.
Really, just the colors. One interesting fact about this movie is it was the first film ever to be 100% digitally color corrected.
It's funny you should say that, because for like a year and a half or something, I teach at Long Beach City College, and they gave me the film editing class. I normally teach acting and improv and stuff like that.
Right.
Mm. And they went, oh, you do podcasts. You can teach film editing.
And I
immediately said, no, I can't. And they said, please. And I had done some Final Cut work and stuff like that, but I was by no means an expert. But I always showed the DVD bonus feature about this, the digital, like, coloring and all that stuff, because it's such an interesting thing and how it like adheres to the whole concept of the film and all that stuff.
No, it is a really interesting process. And the fact that basically the Coen brothers wanted it to have that kind of faded, old-timey look, and they were worried that the greens they were shooting in Mississippi were too green and a little bit too realistic. They wanted it to be more of like a yellow or a brown.
Yeah.
So yeah, Roger Deakins like went through and essentially put like an Instagram filter on the entire movie.
Right.
Just degreening the greens and making it more of like a yellow and brown, and it just, but it completely works here.
Yeah.
And it's just beautiful. It's a movie it does. It looks very autumnal.
Yeah.
And it looks like a painting.
It's amazing. I love just the visual. Roger Deakins may be my favorite cinematographer.
He's the best.
You know, probably. I'm a huge James Bond fan, and he did the latest Skyfall.
That's right, he did Skyfall.
It's the best-looking James Bond movie ever.
Oh, God, without question, yeah. And it is just such a fun movie as well. In kind of incongruously, because it does take place in the Depression era South, which was a time of extreme poverty and racism, and basically, by all accounts, a terrible place.
Yeah.
But they make it look like an amusement park, basically.
Yeah, it's crazy how you watch this movie and it's very lighthearted. They're dealing with racism, lynching.
Yeah.
Like that. And then I feel like this is horrible, but I think it's more the tone of the movie. The time I cringe the most is when they shoot the cow, and I should be cringing at the lynching,
right.
but they sort of expertly handle that in a way that it makes me uncomfortable, because I don't know. Sometimes the tone gets a little they're so good at dark tone and making
it
comedic. There was just a few times in this movie where like it was an extreme racist thing, or like shooting the cow or hitting the cow with the car.
That made me so sad.
Yeah, I think that was the moment where you were most horrified. Yeah, I was like,
but what does that say about us, that there are more horrible things in that movie?
Well, also, you know? But he didn't get lynched.
Yeah, I know.
So I think that's probably why the horror wasn't as much there. Although it was very dark. I mean, when it opens up and you see that, and I should add to this is the first time I've ever seen it because I haven't seen any Coen Brothers movies.
Oh wow. Wow,
I see them one by one.
Yeah.
So when I saw that scene, I was just like, oh my God. Like, it was very sobering to see like a Klan, you know, grouping like that. But then, they made it so darkly comical with everything that happened in the scene.
They make the Klanmen such buffoons too, that it helps somewhere.
I mean, if this is what the Klan actually did, it is so ridiculous. Did they actually like have those choreographed dances and stuff?
I don't know. I have no idea.
I think they actually did. I think so. I don't know why I would know that specifically, but that seems true. I don't know.
The Klan are such great bad guys, honestly.
And second to the Nazis, right?
Second to the Nazis. I kind of miss seeing them in movies because,
you miss seeing them.
You listen to old, like, Superman radio serials. It's Superman versus the KKK. He's taking the KKK.
Do you know about that story that they did on Drunk History, that there was a reason?
Wait, no, I don't.
I'm going to get this wrong, but... One of the writers of Superman did that on purpose to kind of call out the Klan, and so children were starting to hate the Klan and see the Klan as bad guys, and then their fathers who were in the Klan would notice this with their children, and Klan membership dropped precipitously because these fathers kind of saw their kids seeing the Klan as the bad guy because of Superman radio serials. And
wow,
yeah,
it's kind of amazing the power of mass communication.
I know,
I mean, that's almost exactly what happens in this film, too, is ultimately, you know, you've got Homer Stokes, who's the secret KKK governor, is taken down because he goes off and does something really unpopular, and it's heard on the radio.
Yeah.
So everybody knows exactly what's going on.
Yeah.
But yeah, I wonder, I don't even know, are there still Klan rallies? Is that still a thing?
I'm sure.
I was trying to see if I could find something about Ku Klux Klan and dancing. But there's something in 2012.
Everybody, do the KKK dance.
Well, I didn't know how better to Google that. But as a shocking documentary lifts the lid on how Ku Klux Klan is still strong in Mississippi. And it was October 2012.
Yeah, definitely.
So there's a lot of chanting, white power, et cetera, kind of stuff.
I think that this depiction of the South is really polarizing to a lot of people. I remember, again, I saw this movie. It was one of my first really formative movie-going experiences, and I loved it. It was my favorite movie that came out that year. And then I remember I was like looking at movie reviews, and I remember strongly reading the Entertainment Weekly review of this film, which gave it an F.
What?
Yeah.
Why?
And I had never been so angry reading anything.
What was the reason?
Why?
I could read you... A couple, yeah.
Even
couple
if you don't like the movie, I mean, you have to give it a grade. Like,
that's outrageous.
On technicality and how beautiful it looks. And
right, crazy. I would have thought so too. But a couple of the phrases they used in the review were misanthropic flim flam, redneck kitsch burlesque, and basically their argument being that the beauty of the film just makes it seem more like it's a joke on the characters who are too dumb to understand the beauty of what they're walking through. Basically just saying it's a bunch of hayseed idiot caricatures.
But that's kind of the point. And then they have their redemption at the end, isn't it? Who is that? Is that Owen Gleiberman?
It is, in fact, Owen Gleiberman. Yeah, yes. Yeah, no, I mean, I think he's 100% wrong. But at the same time, I wonder, and I'm not Southern, so I don't know. I can't put myself in those shoes. But I do wonder if you're Southern and you're watching this film, you feel like they're just it's offensive on some level.
Huh.
Or if you're black, maybe you feel like they're whitewashing the Jim Crow South and making it seem like kind of escapist good times.
Yeah, I mean, I guess there could be an element of that, but it doesn't seem like it merits an F. Oh my God,
I don't think it merits an F.
No, I don't think. Yeah.
It seems in retrospect like one of those stunt grades. Like,
Wow.
And I'm so critical too. Like every single film we have. Like when we had Josh Kovat a little while ago, and I think I was commenting that I didn't have as many complaints as I usually do, and he's like, is this podcast about trying to convince you that like you like these movies? And it was so funny the way he said it, because I was like, yeah, I guess I'm really critical a lot of the time, and not like I overall have liked every movie that we watch, but I'll be like, that doesn't make sense, I'm not sure about these character relationships, and that's the kind of stuff I get into. And this time I was like, this works. I really liked it. Yeah. Like, I don't even have, like, major whining about, you know, the female characters like I usually do. So, I'm shocked to hear an F since
I hate movies.
You didn't have to say
that's
that
this soundboard.
Time.
That's my soundboard. We have a soundboard.
We do have a Jackie soundboard. We have some new stuff on it, actually. Now you have a gavel.
Oh, yeah.
And this is something you say to for a lot of movies.
She would never do that. Yeah, exactly. Yeah. That's what it is.
That sounds like me on James Bond. I do this James Bond podcast, and it's the same thing. I'm very critical of it, but it's out of love, you know?
Right, yeah.
Because you love something, you want it to go all the way. Or
right,
something.
And... you know, I love that you just said that. I do it out of love. That's where all my criticism comes from.
And it's with the understanding that I think I couldn't do it better than they're doing it. I'm just saying, you know, like, these are things I wish you would have watched out for. Or something.
Except when it comes to Raising Arizona, where you're completely insane. But I don't want to dig into that again.
We don't want to keep rehashing the pain. Anyway, the point is I'm shocked because I am so critical in a way that, you know, I want to make it as best as it can possibly be. Yeah. I don't even see major holes in the film.
I don't think you were really critical of this movie. You liked this movie.
I did. So how did he give him an F? Or get an F?
I don't know.
Whatever.
I don't get it either.
That's so crazy.
But actually, speaking of Raising Arizona, Blood Simple, Raising Arizona, and Oh Brother, Where Art Thou are often considered the Coens' Hayseed trilogy.
Oh my God, yeah.
You know, Rubes and Hillbillies and Rednecks, and just have fun with that. And ultimately, I mean, they're just such fun performances, and they do have their moments of redemption. You know, Del Mar, who's this... you know, complete idiot. He's also this kind of holy fool character, you know, who's like got this really good heart and kind of helps people, you know, throughout the film. Helps
Wait,
pick
which
Tommy
one is Delmar?
He's Tim Blake Nelson.
Okay, that's what I thought. Yeah,
friend, your folding money's come unstowed. My favorite line in the movie.
Yeah,
friend,
great.
Some of your folding money's come unstowed.
Yeah,
he played that character so great. Yeah. I loved watching his face the whole time. It was amazing.
Yeah, just every line of dialogue. Just there's such unique words and phrases. Yeah. You know, God, what was it Everett saying? Would it be the acme of foolishness to inquire if you had any Dapper Dan hair product?
But he's also like he's basically a convict. I know, but he's like one of those fast talking snake oil carpetbaggers that would come to town. And so
I don't
think you can just reduce him to Hayseed. You're not supposed to like him initially, you know, and it's I love the vernacular in this movie so much.
Well, Everett in particular, and it's interesting you use the phrase carpetbagger, because I think he isn't supposed to be the same sort of southerner as the rest of his characters.
Yeah, exactly.
He's very much a fish out of water here.
Right.
I know, Jackie, the first time you saw George Clooney, you said his teeth are too perfect.
Yeah, it really annoyed me. Actually, that's my major complaint of this film, is realism. No, but everybody else's teeth are all messed up, which is correct. And I know that must be some of the actors' teeth, too. What's his face? Totoro's mouth is always like that, but which is appropriate. But, like, Clooney's teeth are just, like, perfect white. And I'm like, if you're in the South in the Depression, you're not going to have those teeth.
Yeah.
It was like... Clooney's a little too perfect, in my opinion.
Then I said maybe that's appropriate to his character, and you said...
Spoiler alert! Oh, yeah.
Because I was spoiling something about his character just by saying
I
that.
I see, yeah.
But it's true that he's not... So. It makes sense that he has perfect teeth, and it makes sense that he cares so much about his hair. He's dreaming about his hair every time you see him wake up.
Yeah, and this is like a heightened reality, too, and I think he's more to match the Dapper Dan on the cover where the big teeth are smiling and everything.
Yeah.
Like, I'm not one for reading too much into movies, but you know with the Coen brothers, you can always look for those little things, and even if they don't intend
every little
necessarily
detail,
wrong.
Yeah, that's the fun of dissecting these movies. Yeah.
But I don't love George Clooney either. That's another problem. I was like, it's perfect. George Clooney, like, I'm a little critical. That's all.
Is this one of his first major roles? That like his first big?
He was. I mean. Okay, I think Out of Sight had come out a few years prior.
Right.
He'd been in a couple of big movies at this point. I don't think Ocean's 11 had come out quite yet, though it was around the same time. It was one of his first... Yeah, it was one of his first real, like, quality movie roles.
Right, right.
Mm-hmm. And he agreed to do this movie sight unseen because he loved every Coen Brothers movie before this.
Yeah.
He's playing a very commonly reoccurring Coen Brothers type, which is that fast-talking kind of snake oil salesman.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
And I think he generally does a really good job with it. Though, if I were to be slightly critical about a movie I generally really love, one of the elements that doesn't always work for me is Clooney's performance, which sometimes seems like it verges on detached.
A little cartoony.
A little bit cartoony, and you know, he goes through some rough stuff, and he does some, like, you know, some bad things. John Turturro says at one point, like, you ruined my life. He did. He really screwed these over.
But you kind of didn't feel that.
You didn't feel it so much from him. The most emotion you ever see him display is, you know, geez, shucks, guys, I'm sorry I got you into this mess.
Yeah, and I realize he's stunned when this happens, but when Del Mar gets hit with the tree branch by Cyclops.
He's and he just says, there. Yeah, he's just sitting there and kind of cocks his head. It's like, why'd you do that, Big Dave?
Yeah, I understand he's like, he doesn't quite get it yet, but that is a moment that always took me out a little bit for some reason.
Mm-hmm.
Me too. I think the joke is supposed to be, he's still waiting to figure out what the moral of this Bible lesson is.
Oh, yeah.
But even if that's the joke, it doesn't really play. He should be more concerned about his friend who just got knocked over the head of a tree branch.
Yeah.
Yeah.
That bothers me in some scenes, and other scenes, I think, is just, he's just a very, very charming guy.
Yeah.
And he's playing a very, very charming guy. And it works when you just see him need to be, when he's playing the final Soggy Bottom Boys concert, and he's just got this grin, and he's doing the hillbilly dances. And you can see, he's supposed to be a star, and he is a star.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. He was right for the role, but I just don't like him, which is right for the role.
Who would you guys put in that role if you had your druthers?
If I had my druthers...
Specifical.
Specifical druthers.
I'm trying to... in the next movie, Billy Bob Thornton takes the lead. Oh, and I wonder what this would have looked like if you had Billy Bob Thornton as the lead.
Oh,
as a kind of a more... maybe a more authentic southerner type.
Yeah.
You could also still be very charming and kind of a rock star.
Right. Oh, that's such a great point.
Hmm.
Who would you put?
I don't know.
When you asked that, I was like, ooh, I don't know. And I'm like, I'm going to agree with Josh.
I don't know. I don't necessarily have an idea.
I think he does it well, though. Yeah. Overall,
I mean, it is so much fun to go through and see a lot of actors who make cameos in various Coen Brothers movies. It's always nice to see John Goodman.
Yeah. Oh, definitely.
For sure.
Excellent as Big Dave. It's fun to see like Michael Badalucco and as Babyface Nelson.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I know.
Just and in a very, very over the top performance, but just another just episode that's a lot of fun.
Now, I'm assuming we'll talk about the Odyssey implications in this thing.
Yeah.
I have a question.
Okay, let's get into that.
I read that they had never read or seen the Odyssey, but were able to piece this together and base it on just things they knew from the Odyssey.
I'd read the same thing.
Huh.
That essentially they never actually sat down and read it.
Because that makes sense. And I'm not an expert on the Odyssey, but I remember seeing this kind of going like, these are really tenuous connections to the Odyssey.
Yeah.
It's not like, I mean, I guess the plot kind of does it. It's more just characters and moments and themes that come in, you know?
Right. So you've got a blind seer that tells the fortune. You've got a Cyclops, John Goodman. You've got you got sirens,
mm-hmm.
You've
the cows. There's killing of cows in the Odyssey.
I think there might have been killing of cows
or
in the Odyssey
or something. Or
there's a character who gets turned into an animal. That's out of the Odyssey.
Yeah, he gets turned into a pig, but they. Like Helios's cows get killed, or he does the killing. I can't remember
at all.
I read the Odyssey in like ninth grade, but I'm certainly not an expert on it either. Yeah.
And he comes home to his wife dressed as like a beggar, which he kind of does in this movie.
Because his wife has found another suitor.
Yeah,
just like happens in the Odyssey. The main characters
a bunch of suitors, like a whole island of suitors, I think, in the Odyssey.
In the book, book it is like four or five suitors who I think Ulysses just kills.
He does, he kills them. And then has inadvertently killed the crew on the original mission, and so two generations of men from this island are just killed because of Odysseus.
Yeah.
It's crazy.
In the Odyssey, and it has been a while since I read it, he does, like, he sails off and he fights the Trojan War, and then he has this long journey back. Isn't it like 20 years till he gets to see his wife again?
At least, yeah, because he's imprisoned and he has to make love to... the woman that owns her own island or something. I can't remember, but
it's like, of course his wife has other suitors. He does stay on the island of Circe for like a couple of years. I think
that's right. Yeah.
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 But the main characters are named Ulysses and Penelope.
Yeah.
And there's a character named Homer.
Right.
But ultimately, I really think all these things are for flavor more than really following the story.
Which kind of messed me up in the beginning because I was looking for it more. I knew that going in, and I think I was like, what's that? What's that? What's that? And I would have not known that and just watched it, you know?
I mean, I think the Coens want you to have that in mind. Otherwise, they wouldn't have a title card saying based upon the Odyssey.
Good point.
Right at the beginning.
Good point.
It's a classic Coen mindfuck, just like the beginning
of
Fargo.
Yeah, it's like Fargo.
Yeah.
What's the beginning of Fargo?
Where they say this is a true story.
No, that's not what they said. All the events happen exactly as this is.
Oh, that's right.
Films.
Yeah. Oh, right. That I love because they're like, the lady doc protests too much. Like, we swear to God this is absolutely true.
They really lay it on thick with the disclaimer about how it's a true story. But you're right. I've also heard they never read the Odyssey, that they basically just based it on the bits of the Odyssey they'd seen in pop culture.
Interesting.
Huh.
What's so
really
weird?
I think the reason they used it is because they envisioned telling this very episodic kind of, you know, classically Greek epic story, which just moved from just plot point to plot point. And it's also gotten criticism in places for being a little bit too much of a Shaggy Dog story. It's just kind of a series of events that don't really hang together.
Yeah.
But I don't know if that's the case. I actually kind of feel like it dovetails really nicely and all the plot threads come together really well by the end.
I think it does do that, but I don't mind it. I kind of like that it's like little... You could break those up into their own little shorts if you wanted to. It really is like that.
Yeah, you could take any 5 minutes and watch it independently and enjoy it just for itself.
They're like narrative set pieces instead of like stunt action set pieces. They're these little like almost cartoon shorts or something.
Yeah. Though you do have a couple of stunt action set pieces as well. I think an early peek in the movie is where they're staying in Pete's barn police show up, and then all the ammunition inside goes off, and the barn set on fire, and the kid drives in. We got our RUNNOFT, and they drive the hell out of there.
RUNNOFT.
Yeah.
And they notice they stole the short round from Temple of Doom foot blocks for the driving.
Yeah.
I was so happy when they saved the pig, too.
Yeah.
That made me so happy. Right.
See, they killed one animal, but they saved another one.
I was like,
karmically,
they
they're
saved
okay.
The pig.
Yeah, so on a karmic level, they're all right.
I read that when they did the CG of that cow getting... It was either getting hit by the car or machine gun, the animal rights people took them to task for that, and they had to show them the digital work that they had done to convince them that it wasn't real.
It looked realistic.
Yeah, it looked incredible, especially for that time.
Yeah, for 2001, I totally bought it. Spider-Man came out in 2001, and Spider-Man just looks like a video game character.
Uh-huh.
Yeah.
But then immediately after that, also funny is that John Turturro, or PD, immediately just tells the kid, go back and mind your pa. You know, still family first, even though totally sold him out.
I know. I was watching that thinking, like, oh, that's so mean. But then I noticed the car broke down. And they're kind of like, well, we got to carry on, so we might as well send that kid back.
Yeah,
it doesn't seem as mean.
You're going to bring the kid with you?
Yeah.
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 John Turturro's performance borders on the cartoonish here, too. It's like his lower jaw's jutting out the entire time. He's almost like a caveman, but...
That's the thing I love about the Coen brothers. They hire people that can take it right up to the line without it being ridiculous.
Yeah. They go for it. Yeah, they play it big, but it works.
Yeah.
Do not seek the treasure.
Do not seek the treasure.
A toad. it's big, but it's fun, and a big part of why I think the cartoonishness works is because this isn't supposed to be a realistic portrayal of the South.
Yeah,
in many ways, it's like what the South is in kind of our collective imagination.
And Stephen Root as the blind,
is
amazing. What he's doing with his eyes is amazing.
Yeah,
they are looking two totally different ways.
Yeah,
that's probably
the biggest performance in the whole film is he's just got this big broad accent and he's tapping on everything with a cane.
But it's so believable.
He's nodding his head and grinning like a crazy person.
And you can't even recognize that guy from movie to movie. He's always so different.
No, he doesn't look like the guy from Office Space at all.
Yeah. Yeah. And when he shows up in a movie and he's just playing a straight character, like in kind of in Boardwalk Empire.
Right.
You don't even connect him to this guy. It's so a million times different.
Coens are great at just casting great character actors who can be really versatile like that.
Yeah.
There's this through line running through the film that I think also carries this a long way as a portrayal of the South, of just escapism. Uh-huh. You know, from the very first time they're playing Big Rock Candy Mountain.
Oh, yeah.
Which is, you know, you're literally watching these prisoners escaping.
Right.
As they're playing this very escapist tune about, you know, the world in the Big Rock Candy Mountains where the sun shines all day and the jails are made of tin.
Yeah.
Soft-boiled.
The jerk that invented work.
The Big Rock Candy Mountains. And actually, I think the most disturbing line in that song is the Hensley soft-boiled eggs.
I know.
Yeah.
Which seems like some sort of like Aaron Brockovich environmental disaster. Like something has gone wrong in the Big Rock Candy Mountains. This is what people in the Depression were feeling. Ultimately, they were going through so many hard times. They found their salvation through that kind of music. It's songs like "You're My Sunshine," and, you know, just good happiness and good times up ahead.
I just love that music. I had been doing music for a while before that, but when that came out is when I really started like digging into that type of music. It's just the best.
It's amazing that this movie can tell like four stories at once, essentially. It is a story about the South. It's a story about the Odyssey. But it's also a story about the roots of American music.
Uh-huh.
from the very first song they play is this chain gang spiritual, you know, like a Negro spiritual,
yeah.
which that kind of music was essentially the roots of like blues music.
Right. And I want to say that is the like an original recording or something that they used for that it's not even something they did for the movie or something for that chain gang song. I could be wrong.
I think that Chain Gang song it sounded too hi-fi to be an original recording.
I know. Where did I read that?
Big Rock Candy Mountains was an original recording. I think they played a version of I'll Fly Away that was original. It's a combination of a couple original ones and a couple, you know, rearranged by T-Bone Burnett.
Yeah.
Just, yeah, full modern recording. Sounds gorgeous.
Yeah.
But it is interesting that you start out with these, both those spirituals and that you have gospel songs. And those are the roots of the music that would become blues when you eventually get to Tommy, who's this Robert Johnson character, literally standing at a crossroads. He sold his soul to the devil.
Yeah, I know. I always loved that. I also read, too, that Robert Johnson stole that myth from an actual blues player named Tommy Johnson. Like, that was the legend that there was this guy named Tommy Johnson that did this, and Robert Johnson sang about it, and then the myth got attached to him or something like that. Yeah, and I couldn't grasp whether he had perpetuated that myth or somebody else did, but it was like once removed from the original myth, which is how all myth starts. Like you never meet the source of the myth, you know, you always meet the first person that told or heard about it, you know, and you can never trace it back to its original source.
You never get to the patient zero.
Yeah,
it's always somewhere back who heard it from somebody else first. Yeah.
Sorry about that dog barking in the background, but it kind of adds authenticity.
It's like we're just recording this in a barn somewhere.
Yeah. Yeah. I wish there were cows mooing, but you might hear roosters clucking. Our neighbor has roosters that lay soft-boiled eggs. And the roosters. I know, it's crazy. There's a real environmental...
Yeah. Seriously, God, what is going on in Southern California? But then it's, you know, you start with those origins, and then you have the Soggy Bottom Boys, who are the white musicians pretending to be colored musicians to actually make it huge and become stars.
Yeah.
And not to mention the fact that they're literal outlaws recording outlaw country.
Yeah.
So it's interesting. I mean, so just, it's almost like they're telling, this kind of shadow history of how American pop music came to be.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. And you listen to these songs, and even if you're not familiar with blues or this kind of, you know, music from the 30s, I feel like on some like instinctual level as Americans, you just feel like this music is like in our blood.
Yeah.
Like you listen to even like the most modern technoed out EDM song and you still hear this music in
there. It's still the same chord progressions.
Yeah, chord progressions just...
Well, now EDM also has that like country flavor.
If you have like Avicii.
It's all
full circle.
Yeah, it's all coming back together right now. But I think when you were leaving, I think I heard you turn on the soundtrack in your car.
I did.
Yeah, I was listening because the music was so good. I was like, yep, Josh is listening.
I was driving home listening to the Oh Brother Where Art Thou soundtrack, which it won a Grammy for Album of the Year.
Yeah.
It ultimately became a much bigger cultural phenomenon than the movie.
Right. So. I had a DVD of a like live concert performance of all these people. So like Dan Tominski, who does that main song.
Who sings the song. George Clooney is not singing his own vocals.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And Ralph Stanley, who does the Ooh, dear. Would you carry me another day?
I think in general, all my favorite songs in the movie are the a cappella ones, which just have this like this primal power.
Yeah,
that and the siren song they have it's bone chilling.
Oh, that one's so good, and you can so clearly hear because it's all three of the women doing the harmony, and then when they cut to each individual woman, you can hear the individual voice. And so Emmylou Harris, of course, she has that low voice, and it's amazing.
Jillian Welch, Alison Krauss, and Emmylou Harris all harmonizing together on that track. Well, interesting too, Jackie, is that when the sirens were singing, you said, I don't think that's them actually singing the song. But when George Clooney was performing, you said you didn't say anything.
Oh, no, it was just that in the context of the way they were singing, it sounded like there was something about the way they were singing that just didn't seem like it would sound like three women singing in that
spot. It is a pretty full sound,
That was just kind of why. I wasn't like... Yeah. Speaking about
I guess that
actresses.
Is true. Yeah, it is like they sound almost double tracked. Yeah. It's like that's not how it sounded. They were standing in a meadow.
Well, or you know, the water lake thing. Yeah.
But still, you know, they're driving past the sirens and Pete looks at them for a second, immediately like bites his fist. And it's like, oh my God, we got to go down there straight out of the Odyssey.
I know. I love that he's just going. Yeah. I can't resist it. In my other IMDb research for this, too, I read that Clooney practiced a bunch to sing that song and thought he was going to, and then he got replaced. But Tim Blake Nelson actually sings that.
He actually does. He actually does sing in the jailhouse
now.
Although I don't know if John Turturro is doing the yodeling.
No, I can say for certain that that's not him.
Right.
Yeah. Oh, funny.
I do. They still, I love them doing the Soggy Bottom Boys, and I love them doing the hillbilly shuffle dances.
Yeah.
And it's just, it's goofy, but it's fun. There is this undercurrent too of faith and fate, and it's part of the interesting, because you have both elements of Greek myth and elements of, like, you know, Southern Baptist kind of Christianity kind of commingling. And both of those have, you know, both of those dive so rely so much on kind of this idea of fate and the idea that our lives are kind of out of our control.
Yeah,
you know, the Greeks, the fates were literal gods.
Yeah.
But as Southerners, you know, there's kind of the idea that, like, you know, we are being tossed around essentially by these forces beyond our control. But if you believe in the Lord and you decide to save yourself, as Delmer and Pete eventually decide to save themselves, you give yourself over to this higher power and you can kind of be saved in the world.
Yeah.
And Everett doesn't go for that because he's this carpetbagger who's an atheist and believes this is all nonsense. But by the climactic scene where they're looking at their own graves, he finally decides to pray, and he is saved by a miracle.
Yeah,
it's a Deus ex machina moment. Right, it is God coming down and saving these guys. Like, there is a God in this universe.
Yeah.
Although he said, "Oh, they were planning to flood this valley."
Right. That's what he said afterwards. He was like, "Oh, it was going to happen."
But don't be ignorant. I interpret that as, he maybe does believe, but he feels he has to keep up the tough exterior or something like
completely.
That. Or at least he's kind of like,
he's still just doing what he does, which is explaining things away like that.
That's the moment where, like, his fast-talking exterior is finally stripped away, and that's just, like, the real person inside who is just kind of scared and doesn't understand. Which is ultimately why I think all these stereotypes play, is whether you are this crazy intellectual, or these kind of, you know, dumb hicks. We're all idiots. We're all idiots in the same boat, who at the mercy of these forces that we ultimately can't understand. They won their pardon, but they were still facing death anyways for no really good reason, and then they were saved for no really good reason.
Yeah, and he got the treasure, but not the one.
They found the fortune, but not the fortune he sought.
Yeah, and I think for Clooney, too, or Everett, he got his love again, and, you know, his family.
Yep.
But you never really find out what happened to the other two guys. That's the one bummer. Like, you know, they just kind of disappear from the last scene.
I mean, are they part of Papio Daniel's brain trust?
You hope Delmar gets his. Wait, who? One of them wants a restaurant. Is it John Turturro?
Yeah, I think it was Pete who wanted to own his own restaurant.
Oh.
And what did Delmar want? He wanted.
I don't remember.
Oh, a land.
Yeah, a man's got to have land.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Friend, your folding money's come on still.
Yeah, no, Tim Blake Nelson is fantastic in this, too.
Yeah.
I always wonder why you don't see him more.
He's just a great character actor, and he just plays dumb but lovable really perfectly here.
Yeah.
He's got that great moment of physical comedy where he finds Pete, who's been turned into a toad, and he's, like, jumping and climbing for him.
Yeah. He's great.
He's really good, yeah.
Yeah, and I guess you could interpret that flood at the end, too, as kind of Poseidon's wrath.
Yeah. Yeah, because Poseidon is the sunglassed guy, right? Who's in the Odyssey, who's, like, kind of tailing him, I think, and is angry.
Poseidon's always one step behind Ulysses during that entire thing.
Yeah. I think he's supposed to represent Poseidon, and he brings that flood or something.
Right.
I don't know what the sunglasses were supposed to be, but just because you don't see the devil's eyes, I guess.
He's
the devil. He's Poseidon. Yeah.
Oh, the devil's not a red and scaly with a bifurcated tail. He's white. He's as white as you folks.
Yeah.
I guess he's kind of the devil and Poseidon at once.
I guess they make him more the devil in this movie. But
right.
Yeah.
Reminded me a bit of Who Framed Roger Rabbit, too.
Oh, yeah. The dark glasses. Welder's glasses.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But if he's Poseidon, I mean, would he have the water come out like that? Because it was, like, against his own goal of trying to get rid of him.
Yeah, good point.
I don't know. Maybe he's like, I'm not going to let you take him. If anybody's going to kill these guys, it's going to be me, sort of thing. I'll kill him with water.
But the water didn't kill them.
And no, they didn't. It didn't.
Yeah.
It did end up saving them. They could have killed him. I don't know.
Yeah.
I don't know.
Probably unrealistic.
These and more questions will be answered on our next podcast.
Yes. But it's so awesome that every one of these scenes can be interpreted through a number of different lenses, whether it is, the Greek mythology or trying to understand the South at the time.
Yeah.
Or any number of things. The gravediggers of that scene are the actual Fairfield Four.
Right, that's right. Yeah, the three of them.
Three of the Fairfield Four.
Well, there are only three.
Is that really true?
I think so, yeah.
What happened? Why'd they call themselves the Fairfield Four?
Because when they recorded, they would do four-part harmony, but there were only three of them.
So one of them would have to dub over it?
Yeah, something like that, yeah.
Hmm.
I can't remember the exact story.
So I thought maybe one of them had died. I don't know.
I don't think so, yeah.
But yeah, no, you know, this old, real classic gospel group singing this gorgeous, terrifying version of Lonesome Valley, and then that is just playing for this long extended beat when you're looking at the water and everybody's drifting through and all the Dapper Dan cans.
Yeah.
It's just a gorgeous underwater shot.
How could you give this movie an F on that sequence alone?
Right. Yeah. Just on an aesthetic level, it's such a beautiful movie. And and even if you don't care about any of this thematic bullshit, it's just fun.
I know.
Great.
Because it's just a fun adventure yarn, you know? I think, Coen Brothers, they always do crime stories, but they manage to shade it into different genres, whether it's a thriller or leaning into horror or just leading into, like, manic farcical comedy like Raising Arizona was. And this, I think, honestly reads more like an old-fashioned adventure story, where they're just going from fun adventure to fun adventure.
Yeah. It's almost like a radio serial in itself, like each component could be broken into a week.
Completely. You know, it totally feels like a radio serial.
It works episodically, but it's overall, it has a storyline, you know?
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
And it does dovetail perfectly when the political C story that you all wondered how it was connecting finally connects at the very end.
Yeah. Oh, and Charles Durning is Pappy O'Daniels.
Yes.
God, I love him.
He was wearing Hudsucker, and now he's back as Pappy O'Daniel.
Yeah.
And how well was that played, too, that... the first time you see him, and he's just this cranky old man, and you assume he's supposed to be kind of the bad guy.
Yeah.
But, which primes you to want to root for Homer Stokes, who's the friend of the little man.
Right.
Right.
And then you find out Homer Stokes is the clan guy.
Yeah.
And Pappy O'Daniel is actually more just kind of lovably cranky than anything else.
Yeah.
Just but an opportunist.
An opportunist. And he is having a lot of fun with that part.
Oh, yeah.
And they literally ride out Homer Stokes on a rail.
That was so funny.
I didn't realize they literally rode people out of town on a rail, but apparently that's the thing they used to. Yeah, as he's, you know, during the when he interrupts the Soggy Bottom Boys concert, everybody's like, boo, and he's like, issue is your issue ain't my constituency.
Yeah.
And then, like, everybody goes quiet, and a bunch of people run in with a rail, and they put him on top of the rail and carry him out.
I didn't catch that.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Oh my God,
it was
amazing.
So weird, too, because I didn't really know what they were doing, so I was like, wait, what's going to happen with this? And they played it so well that they, like, stopped it right before it got to him, and then just, like, quickly got him on it and ran him out.
Did they do that, or is that the Coen brothers just putting something, something literal? I don't even know.
I think I looked it up, and I think this is actually something they used to do.
Really?
It was considered like a community punishment.
Ah,
that's great.
That's amazing.
Yeah. It was just a humiliation to be carried out on a rail.
And after that, when Charles Durning dances on the stage,
he shakes his butt a little bit.
And he does the thing where he licks his thumb and he puts it to his hip.
Sizzle.
Oh my God. That's the best. Yeah.
He was based on two real people. One of whom was actually named Pappy O'Daniel. Oh. He was a senator who had his own old-time radio show.
Oh, wow.
And then Jimmy Davis, who was the governor of Louisiana and also wrote and sang You Are My Sunshine.
Oh, you're kidding.
Yeah.
Oh, my God.
The so-called singing governor of Louisiana.
Wow. That's amazing.
I was going to say it's crazy how you could just like be a musician and turn that into a governor, but
I know.
we live in the state of Schwarzenegger, so it's not that crazy.
Yeah, we got was John Ashcroft singing
Let the Eagle Soar. His greatest one.
Oh, the worst. The worst.
I don't want to keep going too long on this because we do have one more segment, but are there any other thoughts you have on this overall? Just how did you guys like it, not like it? Do you feel like there was anything that didn't work or did work? Or
I love it. I think it's a bit of an oddity, but I love it for that reason.
It's a strange movie, and unlike something like Raising Arizona, which plays a little bit kind of manic and very fast-paced, this is a little bit more leisurely.
Yeah, and you can put this movie on while you're doing other things. You can sit down and totally watch it, but it's nice to have in the background because of the music, and it's a comforting movie for some reason.
Yeah, it weirdly,
is.
With all the dark potential.
Yeah, I know. Yeah. It's visually, it's like sound. It's
yeah. comforting. Yeah. Yeah. It is really comfort, and a lot of, I think a lot of that just comes down to the music.
Yeah.
Which is music that was meant to comfort people in the actual depression. Yeah. So it comforts us now too.
Yeah, I agree.
Although You Are My Sunshine is kind of a dark song when you think about it.
Yeah, yeah. I know. A lot of those. Yeah.
Please Don't Take My Sunshine Away. Listening to the soundtrack driving home, I realized it has the line, "You have shattered all my dreams."
Oh,
it's a dark song.
Yeah, I'm gonna overall say I loved it too. And since it's my first time watching it, and given the Odyssey-like situation in which we watched it, by then I was kind of a little tired and like, "Whoa, what's going on?" But it was so enjoyable to watch, and you know, I didn't complain as much as I usually do. So I think that's a good sign.
It doesn't sound like you have many complaints at all, except for George Clooney.
Yeah, that was really my, because I think it tied up nicely at the end, which I really liked. And yeah. I don't like Raising Arizona as much for its manic pace, like exactly like mm-hmm. what I think a lot of people like about it. And I think this one had the right balance of being like really silly at times and help, you know, and taking very serious things lightly and not lightly, but like darkly and lightly at the same time, the way the Coen brothers do so well. So it was a really good mix of all those features, and the music was just so good that it was just like, at the end, having that all going was just like so satisfying. Yeah. So I think by the end of it, I was like, great, loved it, done.
Completely.
Take that, Owen Gleiberman.
Yeah.
Seriously, Owen Gleiberman. Yeah. What
How
is your
that?
Problem?
Yeah.
I've looked up some other reviews from the time, and he's in the minority. Most people tended to like it.
Yeah.
I have nitpicks about this movie, but they're just that. Overall, this is a movie that I love. It has, like I said, it's got personal meaning to me, because I've got some very strong memories of it. But it's also just, I can go back and watch it, and it's just, it's a weirdly kind of a hangout movie. It's this, it turns the South into this kind of giddy, escapist fantasia. And it's just fun to be there and watch, and you know, hootenannies and all these old Southern characters just kind of clashing with each other. It's a goofy down home good time.
It seems like the Coen brothers movies of any filmmakers are the ones that get like better with time. I remember when Big Lebowski came out, I loved Fargo so much. It's still one of my favorite movies.
Yeah.
That when Big Lebowski came out, I was like, oh, that's entertaining. And then over time you catch all the little things. There are so many nuanced things in these movies that on repeat watchings they just get better and better.
Big Lebowski is like it's the quintessential example of a movie you need to watch more than once to get all those
jokes. So much in, and even Inside Llewyn Davis I really like that, but I feel like when I rewatch it a few times more I'm gonna catch more things.
That's a benefit for me, because the benefit of the podcast for me, because I feel like every episode that we do, the people who have watched it have generally watched it several times. So you guys, like, you know, all know like the nuances and these little themes and things that come together. So I always learn so much. I'm like, oh yeah, that is what was going on that you don't catch.
And then then when you eventually rewatch these movies, you'll be like, oh, now I'm seeing it in a new
way.
Yeah. And I could see where on the first viewing, some of these aren't totally working for you.
Big Lebowski didn't totally work for you. But
I thought it was fine, but like, because of what it represents, like in popular culture, like the Big Lebowski.
I expect
it to blow me away, and I was like, "Oh, it was cool. Like, it's fine."
It's one of those things where the fans do it a disservice because it becomes like a cult-like thing. Like, you know, I've never even had a problem with Dave Matthews, but it's the people that like Dave Matthews that tend to ruin it for you. You know?
That's
like,
true.
I don't have a strong stance on it any other way, but the like, Grateful Dead fans, Fish fans, you know this music more about the fans, and sometimes Coen Brothers movies are that way, you know?
Right, where you're like, if this music is good enough that people dedicate their entire lives to following them around and trading cassettes, it's gotta be the greatest band of all time.
And
then when it's just like, it's like, what the hell is this?
Yeah.
not just another Grateful Dead too much. They're fine. But okay, let's do our final segment, which is something we call Raising Arizona. So this is where we have a quiz loosely inspired by the movie of the week, and we're doing something slightly different this time. This is a musical quiz.
Ooh.
Here's how this is gonna work. I've got a few clips of classic blues and folk songs from the 30s.
Oh, boy.
I'm going to play a clip, and then I'm going to read the name of three artists.
Okay.
Two of whom I made up, and one of whom is the real artist. And you'll have to guess who the real artist is.
Okay.
So, here we go. This is musical clip number one. It's called Tishomingo Blues.
I'm gonna Tishomingo to have my ham bone. I'm gonna to teach a mingo to have my ham bone. These Atlanta women done let my ham bones fall.
So, was that by Wheelchair Eddie, Shoeless Malone, or Pegleg Howell?
Either way, the guy's got it rough.
Either, no matter what, the guy's got it rough. So both of you guys are going to guess.
You guess first.
I'm going to say Shoeless
That's
Malone.
That's what I was going to say, though.
You guys are both saying Shoeless Malone. You guys are both wrong. Pegleg Howell was the blues musician who recorded that. He lost his leg when he was shot in a fight at the age of 21. He lost his other leg a couple decades later as a result of diabetes.
Oh, my God. Can I just say, too, I don't know if it's a Robert Johnson song, but it's a... I had to go so far, girl, just to get my ham bone boiled. That expression, if it means what I think it means, like...
Getting your ham bone boiled.
I think it's a euphemism for...
Interesting.
Yeah.
Every blues song is a euphemism for sex.
God, but get my ham bone boiled. It's amazing.
That's such a funny one.
Yeah, just roasted it up. And by the way, Tommy Johnson in the movie was going to Tishomingo. It's a real reference from the movie. Yeah. It just sounds like a town that only exists in blues songs.
Yeah.
Huh.
All right. Here's track number two. It's called John the Revelator.
Who's that riding?
John the Revelator.
Who's that riding?
John the Revelator.
Who's that riding?
John the Revelator.
Hey, book of the seven. Tell me, what's John the riding?
John the Revelator.
What's John the riding? What's John a riding?
Master Revelator.
Hey, book of the seven.
So, was that by Father Mac Bunsen, Blind Willie Johnson, or Scurvy O'Donnell?
Blind Willie Johnson.
That's what I was going to say.
Well, you might just know that one.
Yeah.
Oh.
But that was Blind Willie Johnson, who's got just an amazing voice, that gritty, deep voice.
Please tell me every one of these musicians has some sort of physical debility.
A lot of them do, quite a bit. No one knows how he became blind, although according to one story, his stepmother retaliated for being abused by his father by throwing a lie in his son's face.
Jesus. This is
lie?
The Chattanooga Reach Around by Torsoless Dan.
Right? It's just a bunch of terrible stories. He was poor his entire life. In 1945, his house burned to the ground, and with nowhere else to go, he slept in the burned ruins of his house until he caught malarial fever and died.
Oh my God.
Yeah. Just a sad life, this guy. But maybe you need that to really play the blues authentically.
Well, yeah. I mean, I live in a two-bedroom apartment, and I can't do that.
Right.
So
it's just, no, it's neither, neither can
off,
I.
I don't know.
And supposedly he played guitar with a knife as a pick, which is just badass.
Dang.
Oh my God.
Yeah. It's a badass man. Yeah. All right, track number three is called It Won't Be Long Now.
What you laughing at, Charlie? Well, I didn't laugh at you. How you trying to barbecue that meat? I don't see anything funny about that. Ain't you afraid you get blamed? Oh, no, I know myself on that. I'm making it good and juicy. That way people like it, you know, these days with gravy running out.
So... that was either by the Chattanooga Brothers, Barbecue Bob and Laughing Charlie, or Bunny and Stokes.
I'm going to say Bunny and Stokes.
What's the first one?
The Chattanooga Brothers.
It can't be the second one. That's too literal as to what we just heard. Okay, I'll say Chattanooga Brothers.
It is indeed Barbecue Bob.
No!
Come on!
The only song they ever had and they were named after.
Yeah.
Barbecue Bob got his nickname because he was a cook at a barbecue restaurant. His gimmick was playing in a white apron and cook's hat.
Oh,
I think he did have a number of songs about barbecue.
Oh my God. That's amazing.
And it's weird how a lot of those early blues recordings were almost like comedy routines on tape.
Yeah.
And they would just do these kind of like goofy back and forths with a bunch of puns. Jeez. And sometimes they would do that for 2 minutes and then sing 1 minute of a song, and that would be the entire thing. Kind of just a weird balance. All right. So this track is called They May Not Be My Toes.
Girl, they may not be my toes, but toes will be sticking out where I used to lay. They may not be my toes. But toes will be sticking out where it used to lay. Don't get so pat on your job. All the women changing men every day.
So that's either Whistlin' Alex Moore, Shemp McKenzie, or Ol' Callie Longhands.
This is so hard.
Well, I'm not going to choose Whistlin' because there was no Whistlin' in the song, and I've learned that they're named by what they do in the song.
Essentially,
so
right.
I'll say Ol' Longhands because he's playing some piano.
What are the options again?
Whistlin' Alex Moore, Shemp McKenzie, or Ol' Callie Longhands.
Unless you cut out the Whistlin'.
Yeah, I'm going to do the Shemp one.
It actually is Whistlin' Alex
Moore. Oh, my God!
So supposedly he would make like an incessant whistling noise as he played piano.
Oh.
But I listened to recordings and I couldn't hear it. Huh. Maybe he was whistling off mic.
Wow. Or it's dog whistle frequency.
Or dog whistle frequency. All right.
So annoying.
All right, this is a Mississippi Bow Weevil Blues.
I'm going down in Mississippi, gonna get a loon down ahead. Suck all the blossom and leave you a happy square on her. And next time I see you, I had your family there on her.
So this is either by Pig Whistle, The Masked Marvel, or Captain Corncob.
First of all, nice job on the red herring names. They're really good.
Thank you. I tried to make them realistic.
Mm-hmm.
Captain Corn, what?
Captain Corn Cob.
What are the other two again?
Pig Whistle or The Masked Marvel?
You're not going to get me with this whistling thing again.
So then then you think it is the whistling
I don't know.
I know, right?
I don't know.
Josh
don't...
is good at this.
Yeah,
he really messes
games.
With you.
Yeah.
Every week I go through this.
Really?
It's torture. Ugh. It's not about music,
usually. It's not literal torture.
It's literally torturous. It's a brain game.
I'm going to go with The Masked Marvel. That just sounds crazy to me.
I'm going to do that Captain.
You're saying Captain Corncob?
Yeah.
All right, Matt is on the board of a point. It is The Masked Marvel.
I got 2 points.
Wait, did you get one over?
We did.
Okay.
Well, we both got a point before in the same one.
Yeah.
So now you have two and I have one.
Okay, so yeah, you have two, you have one.
Okay.
And
all right.
Fine.
Masked Marvel, also a.k.a. Charlie Patton, the father of Delta Blues and teacher to Son House and Robert Johnson. He was called The Masked Marvel on that recording as part of a record company contest. Guess the name of this artist. We're not going to tell you who it is.
Oh, my God.
It's officially credited to The Masked Marvel. And yeah, I love tracks like that just because it's like it's blues and it's like it's most raw.
Yeah.
You can tell there's nothing to that except repeating like the same cadence of line over and over again. There's no choruses, no verses, no nothing. Track 6 is called King Kong Kitschy Kitschy Kaimio.
Frog went a-courtin' and he did ride. King Kong Kitschy Kitschy Kaimio with a sword and a pistol by his side. King Kong Kitschy Kitschy Kaimio. Kaimo, Kimo, Kaimo, Kimo. Way down
yonder
in a holler tree. An owl and a bat and a bumblebee. King Kong Kitschy Kitschy Kaimio. He rode till he came to Miss Mouse's door. King Kong Kitschy Kitschy Kaimio.
That's weird that that's what the title is, because I know that song is Froggy Went A-Courtin'.
Yeah, it's a version of Froggy Went A-Courtin', but that version is called King Kong Kitschy Kitschy Kaimio.
Okay, God, that sounds familiar.
And it's by either Chubby Parker and his old-time banjo, Bog Gently and his mighty mandolin, or Arthur Starr and his magic guitar.
Oh, I feel like it's got to be the banjo guy, because I heard a little banjo in there. Am I wrong about that?
I don't know, Jackie.
I'm going with banjo guy.
I'm going with mandolin.
All right, Matt called it.
Yeah.
Matt was banjo. Yeah. Chubby Parker was a folk musician and radio entertainer in the style of Pappy O'Daniel. Because they even say in the movie, like in the 30s, this is that old timey country music. Even then, this was old timey music.
Right.
It's just like the roots folk stuff. All right, track 7 is called Vine Street Drag.
Thank you.
So that was either the Wild Cot Rompers, the San Antonio Special, or the Tennessee Chocolate Drops.
Could you read them again?
The Wild Cotton Rompers, the San Antonio Special, or the Tennessee Chocolate Drops.
Tennessee Chocolate Drops.
I'm so confident it throws me off. I'm going to say that first one, the cotton ones.
The Wild Cotton Rompers?
Yeah, I can hear it in your voice.
Matt again, Tennessee Chocolate Drops.
You know how I know that one?
Oh.
In my bathroom, I have this little gift set of R. Crumb Illustrated old country acts that like you've never heard of before.
And one of them
like,
is the Tennessee Chocolate
I don't know.
Drops.
I feel like that seemed very familiar
Complete
to me.
Unfair advantage. I want to note that for the record.
That is true.
Matt knows all this kind of music. He has mandolins.
Does he like you coming in with a handicap?
He has mandolins on the wall. He's got old-timey stuff in his bathroom.
I'm better at the folky stuff. I really don't know much about blues at all, so I think I've only answered the folky ones.
The weird thing about that is
racking
like...
racking up points.
A lot of black bands from that era had those kind of like weird self-deprecating names. Yeah. Like there was the Ink Spots.
Yeah.
Like just like names playing off the fact like we have dark skin, which comes off.
And I thought you wouldn't be bold enough to make that a fake name.
That's true. Yeah. you're right, you called that. All right. Three more tracks. Jackie, I think you could still tie this. So this is Bye Bye Baby Blues.
Well it's bye bye pretty baby, baby bye bye.
That's a good song. That's a good song.
Mm-hmm. It is. That's just a good hooky song. Beautiful singing. It was by either Little Hat Jones, Big Hat Jackson, or Hatless Stevens.
Jeez.
Little Hat.
Saying Little Hat Jones?
Yeah.
I'll say Big Hat Jackson.
You got it.
No, it was Little Hat Jones.
Oh, yes! The reason I said that you got it is because he has tells in his voice. And
so
now
you say.
Oh,
he
really?
Does. When I re-listen to the episodes, I'm always, like, I can hear him like, you think it's that one? Uh-huh. And then it's like, he always
So
tells
you say,
it.
Jackie. I feel like I'm disguising by tells.
But now he knows his tells, and so I think he's addressing it. But
mm-hmm. I'm compensating for it.
Yeah, but even this, I've been paying attention. I've noticed that when you're answering it right, I can hear him like, "Oh, do you think it's that?"
You oh, do
it.
Do you? Do.
Yeah. No.
Okay.
I finally get a point though. That's
you
important.
Do. You got
part.
A point. So, Little Hat Jones was a street busker. He had two recording sessions, one in June 1930, one in June 1931. 10 songs total his entire life, and then never recorded again for 50 years.
Jeez.
Just Whoa. Kind of knocked a couple out.
Wow.
Yeah. All right. This track is called Casey Jones.
Casey looked at his water was low. Looked at his watch was slow. On the road again. That phone, he's on the road again. Lord, the people tell by the thought of moan. They made the fire, Mr. Casey Jones, Mr. Casey Jones.
So that was either by Mississippi Tim Chapman, Furry Lewis, or Fats Polansky.
What was the first one?
Mississippi Tim Chapman.
What's the second one?
Furry Lewis.
I'm saying Furry Lewis.
I'm saying Furry Lewis.
Fats Polansky. It can't be right, but that's such an outlier. I'll do Furry Lewis as well.
Smart play. It was Furry Lewis.
Yeah. Come on, man.
Yeah.
I can't win this
all
quiz.
All I have to do is answer what you answer.
Oh, I know. That's what I figure out, too, at the end of every quiz. Yeah.
If you want to be a good game player, you
I
can do that.
I promise I won't.
Well, that's what I started doing in a few bars. I was like, I'll just match.
I didn't, because I thought that was right.
Walter Lewis was named Furry by his childhood playmates. I'm not sure why. Maybe he was just a very hairy kid. He was a street sweeper until he retired in 1966. Despite some success as a blues musician, he held that position his entire life.
Wow. Huh.
Yeah. All right, last track. Jackie, I don't think you can win at this point, but you can at least come close.
Thanks, Josh.
This is I'm just rubbing it in. Uh-huh. This is called Since I Laid by Burden Down.
Yeah.
I love listening to some of those old gospel recordings. There's so much passion, especially mm-hmm. whatever singer's going like really high up mm-hmm. in that one. God, just feeling it. Anyhow, that is either the Alabama Hosannas with Reggie Boyle, Reverend Louis Davidian in the Holy Road, or the Elders McIntosh and Edwards Sanctified Singers. The Alabama Hosannas with Reggie Boyle, Reverend Louis Davidian in the Holy Road, or the Elders McIntosh and Edwards Sanctified Singers.
Alabama Hosannas.
That's the first one, right? Yeah, that's what I was going to say.
It was the Elders McIntosh and Edwards Sanctified Singers. Wow. Yeah, two church elders who had a gospel group. But yeah, just yeah, beautiful, beautiful recording.
Mm-hmm.
Anyhow, Matt, I guess I'm not surprised that you won, but congratulations.
I think I got lucky. What do I win?
You win.
How much
fame
do I win?
And glory.
How much do I win?
Bragging rights.
All right.
Yeah.
Yeah. So I guess we should start making trophies because people start asking. So what happens at the quiz?
Yeah.
Like when you win it, we're like nothing. It's just you win.
Every time you see Jackie from now on, you could hold that over her head.
Oh, I hate losing, but I'm accepting.
You've done well. You've won.
You didn't
last
lose by much.
Still.
You did pretty well, and you've won the last couple of quizzes.
That's true.
Yes.
I'm a really sore loser, usually, and I'm very competitive, so that's why it's funny to have me on stupid quizzes at the end. That's why it's funny. People are like, what do you win? And I'm like, yeah, you get to win. That's, like, enough.
You win. But isn't winning enough?
Yeah.
You need a prize?
Yeah. Jeez.
Anyhow, that pretty much wraps things up. Matt, thank you so much for coming on our show.
Thank you.
Seriously, a pleasure to have you here.
Yeah, I appreciate it. Sorry it took so long to do.
I'm just glad this worked out. This worked out perfectly.
Mm-hmm.
Matt, if people want to find you and find stuff you do online, where can they go?
Well, you can go to mattgourley@twitter.com or @mattgourley, GOURLEY. Superego at gosuperego.com or Superego on iTunes.
Definitely. If you have not checked out Superego, please, please check it out. It's brilliant.
And then I'm going to be starting a new podcast for Earwolf.
Really?
So stay tuned. It's film related too, so I can't
really,
can't really
oh
say
my
much
god
about it yet, but
oh my god, I'm
we're
on the
so
edge
excited
of my, I'm on the edge of my seat.
Yeah.
Cool. Jackie, anything to plug?
Yeah, you could do my Twitter, MacQueline, MacLean.
If you want to read Jackie's brilliant screenplay for yourself, it's
that's
on
right
her Twitter.
It is there. There's a picture of it. I'm trying to think what else though. I feel like you should plug the LA podcast.
Oh, yeah. We're going to be there too. Super Ego and James Bonding.
Oh, no,
which
I'm
is my
so
other
depressed
podcast.
Yeah, Jackie's sadly not going to be there, but
I'm
going to be hanging around LA Podcast Fest. I may even try to record something there. So that's gonna be awesome. If you do happen to be going to LA Pod,
it won't go up before.
This might not be out by the time LA Podfest.
Well,
drops.
Hopefully you saw us there.
So hopefully you already found us there.
God, what a good time that was.
Yeah.
That was amazing.
That was awesome. Yeah. I wasn't even there, but it was so great.
God, nonstop party. Party Central.
Yeah.
Party with podcasters.
Let's try to make a prediction right now as to what happened, like, you know, with our astrology and everything.
Oh, let me just look at my chart. One sec.
On WTF, there will be a blackout in the middle of the podcast. The lights will go out.
I'm going to guess that somebody ran over their time and somebody else is upset because they started later than they wanted to.
Yeah.
That's my bold prediction.
You have a better chance of yours coming true.
Do you have a prediction for the LA Podfest you're not going to be at?
Since I'm not going to be there, I guess, you know, one podcast is going to feel really a little empty
because of a lack of Jackie?
Yeah.
They're just going to feel
That's actually my 100% prediction.
I think it's
lack
true
of Jackie.
I think it's true.
Lack of Jackie.
I think that's going to happen. I feel like all of our predictions are going to come true.
I think so.
So, as for me, you can find stuff I do at joshrichmond.net, you can follow me at Radio TFB on Twitter, and you can check out all the stuff for this particular show, Accept the Mystery, at accepthemystery.net. All the past episodes, go back and listen to the archives if you haven't listened to those. That pretty much wraps things up. Alright guys, thanks a bunch. This was awesome. Until next time.
Thanks.
Peace and love.
Peace and love.